Well, it's my privilege to lead a team of 830 people in Loganair, which is the UK's largest regional airline, and we go about keeping the UK pretty much on the move every day. We now fly to more UK airports than every other airline put together. I have to do the maths on that one, but it is true. Many of those now beyond Scotland, with places like Southampton, London City, Manchester, the Isle of Man being very frequent ports of call for us. But so far today in Loganair, we've flown over 200 customers to hospital appointments, we've delivered over 10 tonnes of mail to the islands, our pilots have taken charge of radiotherapy shots that we had to get to the Western Isles Hospital, we've operated flights dedicated to the oil and gas industry, taking people to go offshore in Shetland, and we've carried out the weekly shift changeover at Sullenberg Gas Plant because it's Tuesday. Also because it's Tuesday, Captain Magnus Slater, who's been flying the Orkney and Trials Air Service this morning, as we have every day since 1967, has done his job, delivered the teachers out to the schools on the outer islands, and flown the world's shortest scheduled flight in doing it. Didn't set a record today, but we don't often do that nowadays. But because it is Tuesday again, when he landed back in Kirkwall this morning, our engineers took the seats out of his aeroplane, and then loaded up with all the foodstuffs for the northernmost island of North Ronaldsay in the chain, which doesn't have a reliable ferry service in the winter, so that's where we come in, to keep the 70-strong population in food. And when people talk about lifelines, that truly is a lifeline. Now, at the other end of the country, Captain Steve Thursfield has just landed in Heathrow with Loganair's Super Jumbo, the ATR-72. It's a Super Jumbo to us, all right, come on. Those aircraft, the ATR turboprops and our Embraer regional jets, are plying routes up and down the whole of the UK and really providing connectivity, keeping businesses running, but also providing worldwide connectivity from those regions with our partner airlines, particularly with British Airways. So I think if you ever wonder how kind of the oil industry workers get to work, how the mail gets to some of the remote islands, how people get to hospital, from whether it be from Scotland or from the Isle of Man, or how those regions stay connected to the worldwide air networks, then I hope it's without any hint of hubris or arrogance that I may volunteer a one-word answer to that question, and that is Loganair. That very broad diversity of our activity, coupled to a can-do attitude from our team, and a very broad diversity of that team as well, I think has been integral to our survival and our prosperity through the pandemic. We were the first UK airline to report our return to profitability after the pandemic, and I'm pleased to say today that we're trading profitably, completely free of debt, completing our fleet renewal programme this year to set us on the path for the next decade, and making some really, really good strides to address the environmental challenges that we have across our whole industry. But even so, it's a notoriously tough business, one in which airlines come and go, and one or two airlines even manage to come and go more than once. But last Tuesday, we quietly marked Loganair's 61st birthday, and I think as the airline's eighth chief executive in those 61 years, for me, it's very much a case of really leading the team as much as it has been guardian keeper of this airline for its next generation. I'm really encouraged to see that our shareholders actually see that in much the same way. And having decided to retire after 25 years of involvement in Loganair and the last 11 of those years as sole owners, they're very keen to make sure that the airline stays in good hands for the future. That process for us to find new owners began last autumn. We were completely transparent about that right from the outset. I think in a business where you have a huge level of openness with all of our teams and all of our key stakeholders about who we are and what we do, it was the only way for us to be upfront about that right from the very beginning. That process to find new owners is well on track, and we hope and indeed expect that we'll have some further news on that sometime later on this year. Now, I mentioned a few moments ago about airlines coming and going more than once, so no prizes for guessing that I was referring to Flybe. The second incarnation of which collapsed around 10 days ago, to the obvious and completely understandable distress of all of the team members who were involved with that. Unlike the first time, we haven't gone rushing in to fill the gaps left by the collapse of Flybe, and there's a very simple reason for that. We don't actually think there were any gaps in the market that Flybe the second had filled, and in my view, that's actually why it failed. There has to be a market-driven need for an airline to exist, and we simply could not see what that was with the second incarnation of it. However, that does belie the situation that we see today on Heathrow slots. Slots that were intended originally as competition remedies, predominantly for domestic routes, are now being openly hawked around the market for sale. And it's simply unacceptable that we find that those slots are really being auctioned off to the highest bidder. In our view, we believe that they should continue to be reserved for domestic access to Heathrow, perhaps more widely than the original stipulations of Aberdeen and Edinburgh. But access to our national hub for regional air services is really critical to the future. We've been working to persuade successive ministers at DfT of the need to make this change to those competition remedies. Now on their plates, because of the events over the last 10 days, they've got a time-limited golden opportunity to actually make that change, secure access to those slots at Heathrow, and open up that worldwide access for places like the City of Derry. For a government which says that its key principles are about levelling up, union connectivity, and those kind of statements, I think it's a very easy, straightforward thing to do, and something that indeed it should. But turning back to today and back to our regular operations, if you look at the kind of way that we operate our aircraft, you may follow Flight Radar 24 and think, what on earth are they doing? And a good example of that is if you were to take our morning flight from Dundee to London City. And you follow it on Flight Radar 24, and it's like watching some trajectory out of Pinball Wizard or something as it makes its way down the country from Dundee, across to Carlisle, down to Birmingham, following the Grand Union Canal for a bit, out to Clacton, a quick sightseeing tour of the East Coast, and then turning back in to come back towards London City. It actually takes us 20 minutes longer on average to fly from Dundee to London City than it does on the northbound, where we just follow the A1 and get there much faster. Similarly, on descent into Southampton, you'll see our aircraft making a 360-degree orbit on final approach into there, which our pilots nicknamed the Winchester Wheel. So often do they do it, on every approach into Southampton, so that they can remain in controlled airspace as we descend. It's absolutely lovely on a clear day to be given a sightseeing tour like this of the countryside as a customer, but really, it's not what we're in business to do. And the reason for all of this is, of course, the design of the airspace through which we have to operate in the UK. The progress to reform this and make changes to get rid of these types of things has just been glacially slow. And the only airspace change proposal that the CAA published last year wasn't to reform airspace around London, wasn't to reform airspace around Southampton. It was to change the airspace around that thriving aeronautical metropolis of Barnsley. Now, at the same time as this, NATS has put its navigation charges up by 29% so far this year. And I have to say, I don't mind paying 29% more if we're getting a much more efficient service. But we're not. And of course, this isn't just about cost as well, it's about the environment as well. And a more rapid progress on airspace reform could wipe out, we think, around 10% of the UK's total aviation emissions at a stroke. It will deliver progress on decarbonisation far faster, far more quickly and far more cheaply than any other initiative on the table today. So it's a point that I'm proposing to press home later on today at the meeting of the Jet Zero Council, which is taking place in London this afternoon. Albeit it'll be interesting to see which secretaries of state that we have following the changes that have been announced this morning. We now have a Secretary of State for Business and Trade and a Secretary of State for Science, Innovation and Technology. And I'm glad that the Prime Minister's decided to separate those two, because if it was one department, in government acronyms, we'd have a department for batshit by the side. Just as we need to look to the future for our airspace, we've really got to look to the future for our team as well. Much like the rest of the industry today, over 50% of Loganair's engineers are over 50 years of age, and that's absolutely common pretty much in any environment you pick up. It's National Apprentice Week this week, and so I'm going to be delighted to present apprentice completion certificates to a number of engineers who've come through in 2023. And we'll be putting a further apprentice round in place for engineering this year as well, and also supporting existing mechanics to progress through to licensed aircraft engineers. We've got to keep investing in these skills, whether that's for our engineers or our pilots. But turning to pilots, we've got a big barrier today for prospective pilots. And across in North America, you can see regional airlines literally going out of business, and the majors parking whole fleets full of regional aircraft because they've run out of pilots to fly them. Now, we're not at that point in the UK yet, but the UK government again needs to rapidly reform pilot training to make absolutely sure there's no risk of that happening here. there are some really significant cost barriers to becoming a pilot. Training subject to VAT, increasing its cost by 20%. And you ask the Treasury, well, why is this? And they say, well, airlines have always been responsible for training their own pilots. And you point out that this is a view from the 1980s, when airline pilots typically either came from the RAF, where their training had been funded by the government, or many of them came from Hamble Air Training College, which was run by British Airways, which at the time was owned by the government. And so government has always had a role in pilot training across this industry, but today it doesn't believe it has. It doesn't stop there, I'm afraid, because prospective pilots also can't access student loans. So our nation's future investment bankers, lawyers, doctors, politicians can all use student loans to fund their vocational studies, but our future pilots can't. The loans are off limits to them. So just as the cost has gone up because of the application of VAT, the access to funding comes down because they're precluded from taking student loans. So against that background, it's really kind of no wonder that we've got some pretty big issues still with diversity and inclusion within the industry and within the flight deck in particular. Logan Air's long been proud to have the highest proportion of female pilots in the UK, but around 6% of air transport pilot licence holders are females. In Logan Air, around 14% of our pilots are female. It's still woefully inadequate, but it's more than double the UK average. And I've also been really pleased over the last couple of years to see a big trend of pilots from ethnic minority backgrounds coming into the flight deck, which now is about 14% of our total as well. But this is really not going to make the changes that we need to have a properly diverse workforce that we need to depend upon. We've done a huge amount, whether it be big investments in maternity pay today, paternity pay, our Flying for All diversity programme, and we really are making strides with this internally, but we need those government changes to make sure that our industry has the skills on which it's going to depend long into the future. But for now, I've got to say I'm really heartened to see the excellent calibre of pilots coming through the training schools, coming into our programme from all walks of life and from all backgrounds, and it's our job to try and do everything we can to encourage them, whether that be new mechanics, cabin crew, team in our ops staff and everybody throughout Logan Air. Looking back, I'm certainly very grateful for all of the help and support I had from many in the industry who gave me valuable time to progress, whether that be Brad and Malcolm and the team at City Flyer in the early days, and before that, very generous time that Phil Chapman, who was the planning director at Air UK, and Gordon Dennison, who used to run Leeds Bradford Airport, which was home to me, actually gave to this teenage kid, not really sure where on earth this was all going to go. But I'm pretty sure I wouldn't be standing here today giving this address if it weren't for all the time and effort that people like that invested in me. And I think it's our collective responsibility to support the next generation in the very same way. Now, throughout all of Logan Air, I think the key part of making our operation happen every day is the spirit and commitment of the team. Do everything we can to make sure that we know every member of the team and that also they know what we're trying to achieve through all of that. Accompanying the role of Chief Executive is also that of Accountable Manager, which is responsible for the delivery of each flight, both safely and in accordance with the regulations. And I couldn't do that without the help and support of that fantastic team in Logan Air, which I'll never take for granted, but will always remain hugely grateful. Keeping that team informed, as we do with a regular video update every Friday, calls every Wednesday morning, and trying to keep everybody on track is no easy task, I have to say. But I think it's right that I would conclude any talk with the same words that each of our staff members will be able to give you off by heart. It's the way that we end every single week's update that goes out across the company Friday morning without fail, which is to say, keep it safe, keep looking after our customers, and keep looking after each other. I certainly wouldn't have it any other way. Thank you.
So put your hand up, just say who you're from and then ask your question, that'd be great. So, who's going to go first? Hands up.
Hello, Rhys Jones from Head for Points. You said you weren't rushing to fill the Flybe gaps. You said you didn't think there were any gaps. Do you think there's an opportunity to increase your capacity? What are your growth plans for the future?
We We already have got quite a significant level of capacity increase coming through Loganair as we replace the last of our Saab 340 aircraft with ATRs, whether that be 42s or 72s. So that gives us quite a lot of natural sort of elbow room for growth. We've got to make sure that that all works in the way that we're expecting to, and the final Saab 340s leaving the fleet probably July, August time this year after 23 years in service with us. So they've done us proud, but it's time to move on. So that does give us a significant increase in our capacity up to 48 or 72 seats. I think adding more on top of that, particularly heading into an area where you've got uncertain economic environment, will probably be a risk that we don't need to take and that we wouldn't be inclined to take. It's not to say we'll stand still. We certainly won't and don't. And I think that's one thing anybody could ever accuse us of, is standing still for too long. But I think we're not looking at something that says, right, we're going to go off and add umpteen numbers of aircraft in the market. I think going back to what I said about Flybe 2, it's got to be market-led. And if you can't see where those opportunities are in the market, then don't do it. The worst thing that you can see in this industry is when somebody says, right, we're going to start an airline, now what is it going to do? And it's normally doesn't get you very far. And I think that's why we've got to keep looking to the market to say, right, if there are gaps that we can profitably fill, we will. But if not, we'll just keep doing what we do.
Right, next question, there's one over here somewhere.
Adam Harris, Jet for You Direct. In the People's Republic of Scotland, if Nicola gets away, do Loganair see themselves as independent Scotland's premier airline?
I hate being asked this question. I think for that to happen, first of all, there's got to be a vote, and that's got to get to happening. And our view on that would be it's for each individual to make their own choice. It is a matter that even when I made some comment in one of our management sessions a year or two ago, there was a deputation from our finance team appeared at my office door within an hour, almost indignant with protest at an off-the-cuff comment I'd made. So. It's an area in which you have to tread very carefully. I think our biggest concern, actually, is around stability of currency. As we all know, you know, one of the main relations in the aviation industry is that with the US dollar. And I think if we were to have something different as a currency, which didn't have the same, I'd say, stable base, we haven't got that at the moment, I suppose, but the same level of dependability and ability to buy forward and hedge as we currently have between sterling and the US dollar. That would give us a real cause for concern, because I think your ability to plan and execute on an economic basis would be much more difficult than that. So I think very much for us, it is a question around currency and stability of currency that comes to the fore. And we have to try our level best to stay out of the emotional arguments on which there are incredibly strong views on both sides, as there will be, but certainly, you know, living in Scotland, you see that very, very clearly indeed. And that's a particular aspect of the debate in which I would not expect you to see Loganair participating any more than we try our best not to today.
I will turn one here first, and then we'll come to our question. Hello, Mark Hunter, Bank of America.
Andrew Brooks. Do you think the Department of Transport understands aviation?
Look, I think there's a point where the Department for Transport in recent years has almost become a dispensing chemist of subsidies to the rail industry. And I think it's been difficult for DfT at times to see past some of that role, purely and simply because of the magnitude of those challenges and the amount of money going out the door. So I think there's been a point where, I don't think the contribution that aviation makes to the UK economy as a whole is necessarily fully understood by DfT, and by default that means that it's not understood in other areas of government as well. Because of course there are areas like Treasury, BEIS as it was until this morning, that have got huge potential impacts on our industry. So, you know, that's really why, from an Airlines UK trade body perspective, there's been a piece of work done on the value of UK-based airlines that we're expecting to launch later this year, probably around May time, to try and get that message home. And that is not just EFT, it's right the way across government. So fleetingly, I think, will probably be the one word answer I would give to your question, but that's not for lack of effort on the part of all of us.
And Malcolm?
Malcolm Ginnell, Telegram News Update. Two questions, really. Do you think, having watched you already said that we ought to ring fence Heathrow, and also, what's your view on the reduction on the APT? Is that going to make a difference on your domestic operation? I believe that up in the cold north, you have different regulations in any event.
Well, taking the second aspect first, APD is still, Scotland had the powers to devolve air passenger duty but didn't take them because of some complications around the Highlands and Islands exemption. So Scotland's APD regime remains the same as actually the rest of the UK. I think in a way it's unfortunate, and it's an unfortunate happenstance of timing that the APD change in April has come at a point where there are so many other economic factors moving. Will you see that directly reflected in airfares? I think with inflation, airport costs going up, carriers' fuel hedging policies coming to an end, I think that reduction will probably be lost in the mists of all of the other economic movements that are going on with passenger pricing right now. It certainly has got a benefit in that I think if that wasn't happening, there'd be a number of routes that would be under some even more significant pressure than they are today, because fares would be having to go up even further still. So I think it's certainly a benefit. I think it's protected the connectivity that we've got today. But will it turbocharge a huge new amount of UK regional air services? I don't think so, but purely because of the timing. But back to the Heathrow point, we do believe that there is that opportunity there with the regional air services that are already existing into London to be able to plug them in to the hub at Heathrow. And I think it's encouraging, actually, that for the first time in many years, Heathrow's charges from the beginning of January actually have changed such that it's now a better economic base for running domestic air services from there. There used to be a minimum charge on departure, which I think you had to put about 56 passengers on the aeroplane to be able to pay that charge, which when you only had 48 seats was always a bit difficult. People then said to like, when we sell the rear toilet and things like that on flights. But so that's, that is a change at Heathrow, which says that they're actually active for that type of business as well and recognise the value that it would bring. So I think it would be unfortunate if the opportunity with the slots that are being touted around for sale at the moment from those competition remedies were to head off and be permanently lost as an opportunity for it.
Hi, Victoria Morse with Air Transport World. Electric aviation is increasingly being seen as a focus for sustainability and particularly the application of that to regional flying. So I'm wondering, for the future of Loganair's fleet, how do you see that developing? So looking into the crystal ball by a few years. And also, is there anything that you might be interested in acquiring from Flybe? Thank you.
The second part's a really easy question, no. The first part, in terms of the decarbonisation missions, I mean, we've been doing an awful lot of work around this. I think the challenges that we see on the electrical side of the industry at the moment are having sufficient range. While we, for example, fly very short flights within the Orkney Islands, the longest is 17 minutes, the shortest is 2. We have to carry reserves, just as you do on conventional fuel, for the aircraft to be able to divert to Aberdeen if Kirkwall Airport's closed, which suddenly means that the duration that you need on the batteries is vastly different than just that for the short hop itself, when you add the legal reserves on for an instrument flight rules recovery into Aberdeen. So I think that's the barrier that we've got to overcome. If I was a betting person, which I'm not, by the way, because being employed in the aviation industry is quite enough of that at times. If I was a betting person, I would actually say that I think hydrogen power will be in commercial use far earlier and far faster than the electric ones, purely and simply because of this, the physics of getting enough battery power onto the aeroplane to be able to work with it. But as well as those, I think there's another really important bit of the industry that between the electric and increasingly hydrogen debate, there's another area that nobody's really spending a huge amount of time on, and that's the non-carbon effects of flying. You can fast forward and you can see in maybe sort of 15, 20 years, you know, we're patting themselves on the back saying, right, we've cracked it, great, hydrogen's the way to go, and off we go. And then it's like, well, no, you haven't. What about all these other effects of flying that you haven't addressed? So that's something that we've been putting quite a lot of brain power within our team to addressing those. And I think it's important we both address them, but also get the reporting of those right. If you look at the Bayes figures today for domestic aviation, they more or less doubled what they think the carbon output of a flight is for the non-carbon effects of CO2. And the reason, when you say, well, why'd you do that? The reason they say for that is contrails, which is all very well, but when you're flying a fleet of turboprop aircraft that don't get high enough to generate them, customers' decisions are being made on the basis of data that doesn't actually reflect the flying that they've got. So I think there's a really important case that that has to change as well, and we've got to inform customers properly around it. And that's something we can do in the very short term as we get to work on that. So a three-pronged attack, I think hydrogen and the non-carbon effects of flying will probably be the things that will come through faster than electric in terms of commercially usable technology.
Any other questions at all?
He doesn't even like
it. I'm sorry about this, but he had to be. I mean, you obviously wear the colours of your airline very well on your chest. There is no question your enthusiasm for what you do. But one question I have, I mean, over the last 2 or 3 years, with the increase in overnight cargo, nextdaydelivery.com, are you under a little bit more pressure now to think about what you carry in the baggage part of the aeroplane as opposed to the passenger side? And bearing in mind the jurisdictions that you fly in, obviously that's got to be a opportunity to make a lot of money carrying overnight freight.
So we have four of our ATR 72 aircraft are dedicated freighters, operating overnight into the Royal Mail network and running delivery flights into the island by day, which actually allows us to make pretty good use of those aeroplanes. Most freighters only fly by night, ours fly both day and night. We think there's an opportunity to do more, and that opportunity, the catalyst for it, is really the fleet change within Loganair. With the Saab 340s, it's always been somewhat limiting in terms of how much space you've got available in the holds. And another thing that we do as well, that very few other airlines do, is we carry domestic pets. So £50 one way, domestic pet, you can take your cat or dog and check it into the hold on our aircraft. I know it's £50 because when we changed it a few years ago, it used to be £10, and we were finding that everybody from Shetland was taking their cat and dog with them. It was cheaper to take it on Loganair than it was to put it into kennels. So you're actually more domestic pets than you could take a stick at one point. And the flats that we got locally when we put the charge up was like nothing you've ever seen. It was an internet riot. Whenever anybody in the look at the ancillary revenue and says, oh, we haven't put the cat and dog charge up for it. No, don't go near it. We're not doing that again. But I think that move to the ATR aircraft in our fleet gives us much more capacity to be able to do more in terms of e-commerce and those types of things, both in and out of the islands. You look at what's produced there, you know, some high-value seafood items, Harris Tweed, Harris Gin, for anybody who's an aficionado, it's good stuff. But that's all mail order. So there are some real products out there that we can start to do a lot more with now that we've got the capacity to do it, but really that's only been the last sort of 6 to 9 months that those have been widely deployed around our network, and I would expect to see over the next 12 months some pretty big strides forward with what we're doing in the cargo sector to take advantage of it and sell that. So yes, you're right, there's a reason why we haven't gone hell for leather after it at this point yet, but we certainly do recognise the opportunity.
Any final questions?
Your pilot scholarship sponsorship, what kind of programs do you have set up for the next year or so, 2 years? How's that going to work?
So we work pretty closely with two of the major training schools in Scotland, Tayside Aviation in Dundee and ACS at Perth, who tend to be the main sort of flows into Loganair. That's been through a supported programme with Tayside in particular, where people can do a BSc honours degree, which does open up the student loan route. It's almost crazy that you've got to force people to do a degree they don't want to get into the career that they do want, but that's what's been going on up to now. So those programmes running forward well. We're seeing, an encouragingly strong calibre of people coming through. We have got a piece of work going on at the moment about whether we can do something more around that in some kind of potentially bursary, more airline-led sponsorship scheme. But again, we're kind of saying to government, look, you need to help us with this. And the other quirk that we have around this is that in Scotland, the apprentice levy that every employer pays on its payroll is treated in a very different way to that in England. You pay into a piggy bank, effectively, in England, and when you have an apprenticeship scheme, you can go and empty the piggy bank to pay for it. In Scotland, you put the money into the piggy bank and it disappears into an enormous mass of Scottish government funding. And trying to get it back out again is a real challenge, which we see with our engineers. So we're working on all of that to try and line the funding up for us to take a more proactive role with it. But at the same time, keeping those relationships with Tayside in particular and ACS moving forward, because they really have served as well.
I just have one question that was asked, because we've talked about it over lunch and it's becoming a real theme. How does the industry become collegiate and get on the front foot about what our carbon footprint is? We saw when we had Heathrow Airport and Gatwick Airport, totally different set of figures about an A320 coming in at 8 o'clock in the morning, different carbon footprint. You're getting slaughtered because they think your ATR is producing, twin otters producing a contract. So how do we say, in the early 19th century, some people thought a meter was 41 inches, some thought it was 38, they then called it 39. How do we as an industry get collegiate and say this is what the carbon footprints are and these are the numbers which we all use? And who takes that lead? How do we, in other words, get on the front foot and not have figures thrown at us, which we have to apply? I mean, because when Gatwick and Heathrow had their things, they got ripped apart. Nothing.
I think for as long as you have government publishing another set of figures, unless we're in agreement with that, we're never going to stand a chance. Because if we say it's X and government still says it's Y, and is reporting incorrectly, then we're on a hiding to nothing at that point. So I think actually the starting position has to be within BEIS. We've pushed them more times than I can count that the way that they report this and the relativity to other modes of transport has to be addressed and made more consistent so that people can make the right choices. But I think we've got to get them in the room. They're an integral part of any solution to that problem, because without it, chaos and anarchy on carbon stats will just continue from there. It will.
Interesting. Well, look, thank you for that, Jonathan. I would ask James now to give a quick vote of thanks on behalf of the club.
Jonathan, thank you for being here today and sharing some very insightful thoughts. I wholeheartedly agree with everything you said on airspace reform.
I wish you the best of luck.
I'm rather embarrassed to say I've never flown on Loganair. But
my next trip up to Ireland, I'm definitely going to book with you, and I hope to have a go on one of your super chambers. Jonathan, on behalf of the committee, on behalf of the staff, thank you so much for being here today. And it gives me great pleasure to present you with our traditional club gift. An umbrella and some engraved
well, that wraps up today's event. Thank you all for coming. As I say, this is really actually, as I mentioned, our second cracking Dublin dinner, our fourth in January. Our next event is March the 1st, the ESG event, kindly hosted by BDO. I know it's very important to you. There is no bar today. Normally there would be, but there's some issues with the bar. So I've been told to say.